Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 299, recorded Monday, May 22nd. Laura Weidman Powers. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Harry's, for guys who want a great shave experience for a fraction of what you're paying now. Right now, you can get $5 off their Father's Day set. Just go to harrys.com/triangulation. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one who has your best interest in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online at quickenloans.com/triangulation. And by Blue Apron, the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. See what's on the menu this week and get 3 meals free with your first purchase and free shipping by going to blueapron.com/triangulation. Welcome to Triangulation. This is a show where we talk to some of the most interesting people working in technology today. I am thrilled to have as my guest Laura Weidman Powers. Laura is the founder and CEO of Code 2040. It's a nonprofit dedicated to closing the gap, the achievement, skills, and wealth gap in the U.S., and creating access, awareness, and opportunities for top Black and Latino engineering talent. Laura has a BA from Harvard, a JD, and an MBA from Stanford, was formerly a senior advisor to U.S. Chief Technology Officer Megan Smith under the Obama administration. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us, Laura.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So let's talk first about Code 2040. Why don't you explain a little bit about what it is?
Sure. So Code 2040 is a nonprofit. We're based in San Francisco. And really, the sort of animating principle behind our work is the goal to close the racial wealth gap in the U.S., to ensure that the economy works for everyone. And we see the tech sector as actually the best shot for us to do that. It's a sector that is creating a lot of jobs, and it is also infiltrating a lot of industries around the country. And it turns out that the jobs that exist in the tech sector are actually hugely well-paying. So the average salary of an entry-level tech worker is more than the median household income of a Black family and a Latino family combined. So when you think about the goal of closing the wealth gap in the U.S., having the chance to create pathways into and opportunities for Black and Latinx tech talent is actually a critical step if we're going to ensure that folks are represented in one of the most important parts of the economy moving forward. So we run programs for Black and Latinx students and for entrepreneurs to help us get to that goal.
And Latinx is the way you would say Latino and Latina.
Yeah, right? Okay. That's right. Sort of a gender neutral term for folks from a Latin background. Yeah.
That makes sense. When you put the numbers around it, like the idea, I mean, I live around San Francisco, you live in San Francisco, you see that the people in the tech industry are making a ton of money, a ridiculous amount of money. But then when you put the numbers on it, that they're making more than the median family, that's crazy. And I feel like that's what is one of the most interesting things about Code 2040. Like, you're really putting numbers on these things that, like, Silicon Valley loves to talk about, diversity in tech, and it's a good thing, tell us where the name came from, 2040.
Yeah. So we see our name as kind of a call to action. 2040 stands for a year, the year 2040, which is the start of the decade when people of color will be the majority in the U.S. And we see that as almost a deadline for the organization. How do we make sure that we close the wealth gap by that year, as opposed to just waiting for it. You know, I read a stat recently that if we wanted to see the wealth gap between blacks and whites close in the U.S. and we didn't do anything differently, we just waited, it would take 228 years. And so we're saying we want to do it by the year 2040, which is bold and ambitious, but that's the kind of deadline that causes you to think really differently about what's possible and the types of initiatives to run and choices that you can make if you believe that that kind of change is possible in that time frame. Today, the racial wealth gap, the net worth of a white family is around $110,000, $115,000, and of a black family or a Latinx family, it's about $5,000 to $7,500. So it's really substantial. And we're really looking at 2040 as the year when we want to see that close. And we think proportional representation in the tech sector and the innovation economy is a good goal that will get us there.
So you say you're taking an ecosystem level approach. Can you describe what that means?
Yeah. So I think a lot of times people say are sort of looking for a silver bullet, like what's the one thing that we can do? And really, as we've done this work over the last 5 years, we realize that unsurprisingly, there is no silver bullet. If it was that easy, then this would have been done already. So we started with the Fellows Program. We just ran one program and we started in 2012. And over the years of running the Fellows Program, we actually learned a huge amount about what was happening in the ecosystem and what other sorts of programs or initiatives could help sort of form that 360 approach that would actually create the type of change that we wanted to see. So the Fellows Program is really a bridge building program. We have the talent on one side, the Black and Latinx computer science students that we find from all over the country and bring together over the summer in the Bay Area. And then we have the companies on the other side. We partner with dozens of tech companies each year who are interested in becoming more diverse and inclusive and in hosting students as part of the program. And we build the bridge in between them. So we place the students in internships. We run what's really a summer accelerator, a career accelerator for those students. They get mentors, workshops, speaker series. And by the end of the summer, they have not just the experience from that internship, which for about two-thirds of them is their first internship in the industry, but they also have the confidence, the connections, skills that they didn't previously have. So running that program is a fantastic way to sort of build bridges between existing talent and existing opportunity. But it also helped highlight for us what's happening, for example, in the companies themselves, companies that are saying that they are committed to diversity and inclusion, and yet are in some cases getting in their own way. So we started developing programs for companies, for students who are super excited to get into tech, but don't have a sense of how to get their foot in the door. How do we design for students as well to sort of help them be their own path into the industry? And then we realized that about 80% of the students that we work with are actually interested in starting their own companies. And so we're talking about both sort of the existing companies and ecosystem that's out there, but also what's going to be built in the next 5, 10, 15 years. And all of these things are really interrelated. And what we realized is that by running these programs, what we were learning was helping us develop insights that made us really well suited to working in other parts of the ecosystem. And also that if you look at the participants in our programs, they sort of flow between these various programs as well. So a student that we work with on campus might end up being a fellow and then become an entrepreneur and then end up hiring another student. And so it really is this ecosystem, and just sort of dipping in one piece of it wasn't actually going to create that systems level change that we want to see over the next 25 years.
So you started the company in 2012, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and
that's
so
right.
Do you have some success stories already? You said that there were a lot of fellows moving from one area to another. Can you tell us some of the success stories that you've had already?
Yeah, so the example I was just giving is actually not theoretical. We have a student, Chaz, from the first summer. He was one of our first five fellows when we piloted the program in 2012. One of the students who really helped co-create what the summer looks like. And Chaz got an internship through Code 2040 at a Bay Area tech company. He went back, he finished his degree, and he decided that he wanted to start a company. And so he joined up with some co-founders, worked over a few years getting a company off the ground as the CEO, and eventually raised a round of funding. And when it was time to hire, he went back and hired a Code 2040 fellow who was a few years behind him because he had access to this ecosystem of talent. Which is one of my favorite examples because it just shows how that pattern is going to repeat itself moving forward. Because, you know, if you think of that, that's one of our first five fellows. And this summer, we'll have 140-ish fellows coming together over the Bay Area. So you can imagine what that starts to look like as the fellows program scales, the types of opportunities that the students not just take advantage of, but that they create. And we have a lot of great examples of students going on to not just get jobs in tech. 100% of our fellows actually end up graduating and working in tech as opposed to going into another field. But there's also the leadership that they take on when they're in these companies. So advocating for diversity and inclusion, ensuring we have one student who was working at a tech company that was hosting Code 2040 fellows. And she realized that it was great to have the students as interns, but the really important thing was to convert them to full-time hires. And when she approached the HR team to ask them about their strategy around that, the team said they hadn't thought that through. And she was the one who actually said, you know, if you're really serious about diversity and inclusion, this can't be just about a summer internship. This has to be about full-time hires. So you need a strategy for converting these students from interns to full-time. And they went away, came up with a strategy, and it was successful. And then when those students graduated, they joined the company full-time. So it's students who are learning ways to not just succeed themselves, but also be an active member of leading their companies towards this type of diversity and inclusion work.
So you said that there's not one silver bullet, and Mike in our chat room said we need many silver bullets. It's true. And one you just described, that access to that talent. You hear a lot of people saying, I mean, you don't hear it so much anymore because, you know, a lot of they've been scolded for it. But you hear a lot of people saying, like, we want a diverse workforce, but we don't want to lower the bar. And a lot of what you've written about is that, you know, just how offensive that is. And really what you're talking about is giving people access to this talent that is already there. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that always struck me about that phrase, kind of lowering the bar, is, you know, first of all, I've never heard anyone say that about a white man. I would hire more white people, but I don't want to lower the bar. Or I would hire more men, but, you know, we can't drop our standards. The quality of folks who are in the majority group or in positions of power is assumed, and the quality of folks who are not present is doubted. And so that's one of the ways in which this kind of shows up, is just that doubt that someone who is not, has not already made it, could possibly make it. But really what we discovered when we dug deeper with companies is that even the companies who were saying something like that, or who had representatives who were saying something like that, actually then couldn't go on to define what the bar even was. So there was this mythical bar they were worried about lowering, but they didn't actually even have the ability to say, well, this is the bar and, you know, these are the qualifications. And a lot of times part of what was happening was that because the types of qualifications required for a given role were not super well defined, it left too much wiggle room for people to just make choices they felt more comfortable with, or to not go out and sort of push themselves to source and vet and understand talent that didn't come from backgrounds that they were familiar with. And so some of the work that we've done with companies is saying, you know, nobody's saying that you have to lower the bar, but actually it probably is a good idea to create an understanding of like, what are the actual qualifications required for a given role? Because then when you see someone from a background that maybe doesn't look familiar to you, or maybe you wouldn't assume that that person would kind of have what it takes, you can actually measure them against some objective qualifications. And that can really help with kind of the fairness in your sourcing and hiring. So we actually had a group of about 9 companies who had hiring managers and engineering leads who came to our office over the course of several months and actually challenged all of their assumptions about what their bar was and what their companies needed when it came to entry-level talent, because they found that in a lot of cases that work just hadn't been done. And because of that, there were a lot of sort of ad hoc decisions being made, which didn't lead to the most inclusive and equitable kind of distribution of opportunity. And so they actually threw out their entry-level hiring processes and rebuilt from the ground up. And in the case of Medium, who's been a company partner for a really long time, a great partner, they published what they did. So now their entry-level hiring process is published on Medium. And anyone can see that, which has the added benefit of meaning that you don't need to have a friend who works there already to know what the interview process looks like. You can actually just go on their website and read it through, and everyone gets access to the same information. So we have seen companies kind of get past that mentality or design for a better mentality that isn't this kind of, I don't want to lower the bar. But you still hear that from time to time, that kind of conflation of diversity with kind of a degrading in quality, which is both untrue and offensive.
Yeah, you hear things like that all the time, or just imposter syndrome that I've, you know, that just came up a few years ago. It's like, oh, you know, the problem is me. Like, I, you know, I feel like I nobody looks like me, so I feel like I'm an imposter. And that, you know, rang true to me in a lot of ways. But then, you know, I was reading about that, and it's just like that's blaming the victim, I guess, blaming the person for, you know, oh, it's your fault that you're not feeling comfortable in a place where no one looks like you and no one's making any effort to understand you and where you came from.
Well, I think things like imposter syndrome are super real. And we actually, for a lot of the students that we work with, they felt it before, but they didn't know there was a name for it. Mm-hmm. And it's actually really empowering to have a name to that feeling, because for the first time they realize that it's actually not about them. It's about the environment, and it's a reaction that they're having to the environment that they're in. And there's then a path forward to kind of dealing with that. But it's also something that we talk about not just with the students, but with the companies themselves, because it's important for them to understand this phenomenon, because frankly, they're creating it via the environment. So even though it's kind of a stress reaction that an individual has, it's something that a company can design around and temper. And frankly, if a company wants to become more inclusive and more diverse, they're going to have to figure that out. Because I don't think we've seen a single case where a company has said, we care about diversity, we're going to become more inclusive, and then overnight, their numbers have changed. It's a journey and a path. And it's actually kind of getting that started, where you have a culture that's maybe not as inclusive as you thought it was, or not as welcoming as you thought it was. Like, starting to change that is a prerequisite for actually getting your diversity numbers up. And too often companies approach it in the opposite way, where they think about sourcing and hiring as the starting point, and then they're surprised when folks don't wanna like apply or take an offer, or they're there and they're there for a year and then it's a horribly unpleasant experience and they leave. Whereas if you do the hard work of kind of designing your culture to be more inclusive, then it actually makes your recruitment efforts a lot more productive in the long run.
So yeah, you mentioned that a lot of the fellows, they'll go on to start their own thing. I mean, are you noticing a lot of people looking at, now that we have diversity reports and more transparency, looking at companies like, you know, Apple, Facebook, Google, Twitter, and saying, whoa, their numbers are low. I have all this talent. I'm just going to start my own thing. Have you seen a lot of that?
Yeah, I think we've seen that and we'll see more of it. The interesting thing for companies that participate in Code 2040 is we hear from a lot of students that they have that reaction or impression when they think about working in one of these tech companies. So they say, yeah, that company sounds really cool, but like I've seen their diversity numbers. Why would I want to put myself through that? And Code 2040 actually becomes the community that they are not necessarily going to get in, you know, 9 to 5, they'll get it after 5 p.m. And so for students, that's really appealing. And we have a lot of students who actually are looking at two different offers, one with a Code 2040 partner company and one with a non-partner company. And they choose the partner company because they know that it comes with the sort of community and support of Code 2040. And the same goes for the companies. It's a competitive advantage for them because they may not overnight be able to change their diversity numbers, but they know that by partnering with Code 2040, they can still provide a really robust experience for students from underrepresented backgrounds, for Black and Latinx students in this case. So we certainly see Code 2040 kind of being a path towards participating in the industry for a number of reasons for students. And we also see students who are graduating who are saying, like, yeah, I'm going to work in the industry for a few years, but really what I want to do is start my own thing. And that's super exciting because if you think about the companies that we kind of talk about and read about in the news today, a lot of them were not around 5, 10, 15 years ago. And these are some of the most valuable companies in the world. And so you think about kind of from today to the year 2040, the companies that are dominating the industry and the landscape over the next 20, 25 years, even the next 10 years, are probably going to be companies that are being started right now or in the next few years. So there's huge opportunity for Code 2040 students, but folks broadly to actually say, not just, I want to go work at, you know, one of these giant market cap companies, but actually I want to go create one of those.
So do you what are your models for this? I know that, you know, in recruitment for colleges, they will often do similar programs, like fellows programs. Go in as a group. There's more success. People who have been recruited to a college and then, you know, not succeeded, it wasn't anything to do with their talent or intelligence. It was really just that they were lonely. One of the reasons. I mean, bigger than that. But is that one of your models? Do you have other models that you base this on?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we were first starting Code 2040, one of the things that I did was went and sat down and talked to leadership at a number of different organizations to learn from their approach. And one of them is what you're describing. The Posse Foundation is probably best known for that, where they send posses, groups of students from underrepresented backgrounds into a collegiate environment together. And not just sort of coincidentally together where there's, you know, X number of students of color on campus, but actually as a posse supporting one another. And so I talked to the folks at Posse Foundation because that type of, how do we create that peer support as a really critical element of success, was a big inspiration for the way that we structure the Code 2040 Fellows Program. Another organization that I talked to is Sponsors for Educational Opportunity, or SEO, which is based out of New York, that places underrepresented minorities in finance and kind of more banking, more traditional industry. And that idea of how do you kind of partner with a company to help bring them a new pool of talent that they might not otherwise have access to for a variety of reasons. I took a lot of inspiration for that. And Tristan Walker, my co-founder, was an SEO participant when he was in college. And you can think of actually those kind of two models as really melding together to form the Fellows Program, that idea of like the access to the opportunity and like getting it with your posse, but in a work environment as opposed to a collegiate environment, was really important. And it was really, again, that kind of the Fellows Program model that then led to the insights that helped us build out new programs. So one of our other student-facing programs is called Tech Trek, and it's basically an alternative spring break. I went to business school, and when I was at Stanford, there were these treks that were sort of career treks. So there was like a hospitality trek that went to Vegas. There was a like luxury trek that went to, I don't know, I think Paris and Milan. It was very fancy. I remember looking at these kind of groups of students going on these career treks and thinking like, this is great to do in graduate school, but like, what kind of exposure parallels this as an undergrad? Like I didn't get any of that sort of real world exposure in this way. So what we designed was a tech trek, which is an alternative spring break for Black and Latinx computer science students to come together. We brought 50 students from around the country together this March, and we spent a week visiting tech companies, doing kind of lunch and learns and evening networking events. And again, these sort of parallel goals of the pathway into these companies and kind of getting that exposure to the industry and an understanding of what a career in tech looks like, and building those peer bonds that are going to allow students to support one another through the rest of their academic career and through their professional careers as well.
So I don't know if this is the Posse Foundation that did this research, but I've definitely read that part of the success of these programs is mentors, you know, who can talk to the people that are coming in before them. That's just as advantageous for the people coming up as it is for the mentors themselves. Mm-hmm. I know you talked about just giving access to the Code 2040 fellows, but are you seeing that as some people graduate and finish the program, that it's helping them in their careers being able to help the people coming up?
Yeah, so mentorship is a big component of the Fellows Program. And the funny thing is, when we included mentorship, the goal was to, of course, support the students. A lot of them had never had a mentor before. They didn't know anyone working in the tech industry. And so this was a way to get them the sort of guidance and coaching and help them develop a vision for themselves in the industry. And what we discovered was that actually the mentors were getting as much out of the relationship as the students. And we've always had way more mentors than students. We actually have an application process for mentors because there's such a craving both among sort of Black and Latinx engineers and folks in tech to do something about the lack of inclusion and to kind of give back, and amongst allies who have for a long time felt perhaps uncomfortable with the lack of diversity, but have not known what to do. So it's been a really amazing opportunity to not just support the students, but to actually build community amongst the mentors and have them kind of take a leadership role in creating this change. You know, one of the things that we've talked about a lot recently at Code 2040, we have this big audacious goal to close the racial wealth gap by the year 2040 and to use the tech sector to do it. And, you know, we're like 30 people and a team and, you know, in an office in San Francisco. We know that it's not going to be the 30 of us. It's going to be the community that we build. And we have about 5,000 folks who are in our community today who've gone through a program or an experience with us, whether it's students or entrepreneurs or mentors or managers or volunteers. And we project out over the next 3 years to the end of 2020. And we think that community will grow to about 40,000. And that's a community of a thousands of Black and Latinx engineers and entrepreneurs and technologists, and thousands of allies who really believe in making the economy work for everyone and using tech as a lever to get there. And there really is a space for everyone who is willing to kind of roll up their sleeves and engage in the learning and the leading that is required for the movement. So I think the kind of thinking about mentors is a great way to think about like a totally different way to participate in this kind of movement and with an organization like Code 2040, when you're at a different point in your career, but still really craving that kind of community and support and the ability to give back.
Well, I want to talk about this particular student, who you're looking for, how far down the tree roots are going, and a little bit I'd like to also talk about the leaky pipeline, which we've sort of talked about, but give a name to it. But first, I want to take a second to thank one of our sponsors. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Harry's. Now, if you shave your face, your legs, whatever part of your body, you know razors can get expensive. And there are two people who started a company called Harry's that's aimed to make it a little less expensive, a little less hard to get your razors at a good price. You probably heard of Harry's. We've talked about it for a while. It was started by Jeff and Andy. They were fed up with being overcharged for razors, so they started their own razor company to give people what they deserve, to give you what you deserve, a great shave at a fair price. Harry's shave sets start at just $15. They include everything you need for a close, comfortable shave. A weighted ergonomic handle, feels good in the hand. That's what we like with our cell phones and our razors. 5 precision engineered blades with a lubricating strip and a trimmer blade for trimming. Rich lathering shave gel also included, plus a travel blade cover. Now here is the kit. I'm holding one in my hands right now so you can see what comes in it. It's nice. The kit is nice. This is great for a gift. And as you know, Father's Day is coming up. Don't give people an old tie. Give your dad or your partner this shaving kit from Harry's. Everything you need in there. It's pretty great. Plus, it comes in this comfortable box, and it just starts at $15. So we're not talking expensive here, but it looks expensive. That's what you want in a Father's Day gift. You want your dad to think you spent a lot of money, but you didn't. Right now, you can get $5 off Harry's Father's Day set or any of their starter sets. Give the gift of a great shave for Father's Day. It starts just at $15. That's where it starts, $15. And you can go up, but it's $5 off any of their sets, not just their Father's Day set. So go to harrys.com/triangulation. Remember to add triangulation at the end so they know that we sent you there. Plus, use the code, and then you can get $5 off your shave set. And we thank Harry's for sponsoring Triangulation. If you're just joining us, I am talking to Laura Weidman-Powers, who is one of the founders of Code 2040. Laura, we've been talking about your organization and everything that you're doing to get the talent that's out there into tech companies. The leaky pipeline is something that people throw around a lot. It comes from the pipeline problem. That's what people said. And describe a little bit your view of the leaky pipeline and what Code 2040 is trying to do to stop it, I guess.
Yeah. So it's so interesting. You know, the leaky pipeline is a really popular kind of metaphor or explanation for what's happening because it's really easy to wrap your head around. It's really linear. And there is certainly a version of a pathway into tech that is linear and could be described as a pipeline. I think it can be useful to understand sort of that path for an individual who maybe, you know, starts in kindergarten and ends up in their career and kind of what happens there. But I think the context around that is really critical as well, because there are, particularly nowadays with things like coding boot camps, and, you know, endless ways to self-teach, that there are a lot of pathways into tech and into the tech industry. And at a lot of companies that we think of and name as tech companies, the majority of jobs are not technical. And at a lot of companies that we think of as not companies, a sizable minority of jobs are technical. So it's actually, unfortunate for the metaphor, but much more complex than thinking of just a single pipeline with leaks along the way. So that said, as context, we started Code 2040 because there was this narrative that it was a talent issue. The talent wasn't out there. And usually that followed with well, it's because there aren't enough computer science majors, but really there aren't enough computer science majors because there aren't enough Black and Latinx folks taking the APCS exam. And that's because their eighth grade math classes aren't good enough. And really, don't we have to start in kindergarten? And it ended up being this slippery slope to we have to fix public education in America. And while I do believe we have to fix public education in America, that actually obfuscates the variety of different opportunities there are to create change today. And so Code 2040 was built on this premise that yes, there are many things wrong with the quote unquote pipeline, but if you look at folks who make it all the way through, all of the leaks that are usually called out, 18% of computer science grads each year are Black and Latinx. And yet, if you look at the industry numbers, that's more like 5%. Some of these big companies, it's 1-3% Black and Latinx. And so there's something happening way past the education pipeline that's looking at actually that transition from education to employment and turning those skills into economic empowerment. And so when we think about the folks who are working at various other stages of kind of the educational journey, we hope that Code 2040 is kind of the multiplier effect, because if folks are actually making it all the way through the various stages of getting your education and getting the math foundation and getting exposed to computer science and deciding to pursue it and then graduating with a degree, we want to make sure that those folks make it into industry. And at the same time, I think there's no need for the industry, whether it's existing companies or, folks looking to start new companies, to feel limited by, did I study CS as an undergrad? So we work specifically with students who are technical. But if you look at the ecosystem as a whole, there are so many ways to be in tech and contribute to tech that I think getting fixated on the leaky pipeline can actually distract from the broader suite of solutions and interventions available to us to create a more inclusive sector.
So you work with just engineers, Black and Latinx engineers. And the idea behind that is that if you are able to change the tech industry in that sense, the people creating, engineering the programs, that might create an overall change? Or is it because engineers are more highly paid than other people?
All of the above. So we started with engineers because if you want to get a company's attention, saying that you can bring them engineering talent is a really great way to start. Every company is looking for more engineering talent and feels like they are in really tight competition with other companies in order to get it. And so rather than coming to a company and saying, hey, you should be more diverse, you should be more inclusive, what this allows us to do is come to companies and say, hey, don't you want more engineers? And use that as a way to start the conversation. Because a company understands the business implications of being able to staff their technical teams appropriately. And that is a lead-in to the business implications of, well, if you are hiring, if you're sourcing and vetting, hiring and retaining a more diverse workforce, then actually you are serving the need of feeding that area of your business. And same goes for companies. We're having a lot of conversations with companies in New York right now. And same goes with companies there who may not be sort of your traditional tech companies. I mean, a lot of the big financial institutions are about a third technical, and they're competing against companies who maybe have more flashy brands for engineers. And so this is a great entry point to talking to them as well. So the fact that the skill set is in such high demand actually makes it a really useful tool to have a broader conversation about diversity and inclusion. And it also helps that the engineering skill set is one that can be measured, not perfectly, but easier than some other skill sets as well. So when you're having, you know, particularly early on, this doesn't happen as much these days, but early on when you're having that debate about quality, is quality talent out there? You could say, well, like, look, here's the test that you use to see if your engineers kind of can pass that quality hurdle. Like, our engineers pass that quality hurdle. And that's not something that's as easy to say when you're talking about things like marketing or legal or sales or stuff like that, where kind of proxies for ability are much more common.
So are you focused only on getting the students into these engineering jobs? Or are you also focused on the salary gap, which is also huge with Black and Latinx?
Yeah. So one of the things that we do is actually provide support for our students around negotiating their offers. And one of the things that, you know, is useful about being in a community like this is folks can actually share, well, this is the offer I'm getting. What's the offer you're getting? And then we have folks in our community who have negotiated, you know, a dozen offers over the course of their career and can sit down and help them negotiate that up to try to combat that on an individual basis. We haven't gone down the road with company partners of kind of enforcing that type of analysis around the wage gap internally, although there are some other great organizations out there who provide that sort of service and support, which is really important. But we do encourage companies to start tracking all sorts of data. A lot of times when companies first start working on the diversity issue, it's like you can walk down the hallway and tell, but they don't necessarily have data about the actual makeup of their workforce because it's not something that you ask in a hiring process. And so if you don't then actually design surveys around it once folks are in the door, then you may just not have the data at all. And while, you know, gender is an example where you can sort of analyze and kind of a computer program can make best guesses about the gender of an individual based on their name, that's a lot harder when it comes to race and ethnicity. And so often there's actually like a lot of design that companies have to do around getting the type of data that would help them analyze that gap. So we've tackled it mostly from the individual perspective as a way to empower and support the folks in our community.
I've thrown out all the buzzwords, so I'm going to just keep at it in the buzz terms. Unconscious bias training. I've heard you talk a little bit about that. Now, I've heard that the more you talk about unconscious bias, the better people are at recognizing. Just the first step is recognizing that you have it. But I've heard you talk about how some companies just do unconscious bias training and then they call it a day. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So, you know, I was a psychology major at Harvard as an undergrad, and pretty much what is in the unconscious bias trainings that I have seen or sat through is generally what was covered in my like intro to psych 101 class. So like all this stuff is true. And if you don't know about it, like, I think it's useful to know about it, but it's not always the most effective tool to actually create the type of change that companies implementing it or ostensibly looking for. And we see that because two things. One is folks can feel like they've checked a box, like particularly if this is the entirety of the company's strategy is like, let's have everyone do unconscious bias training. Then as, you know, XYZ employee, I show up at the unconscious bias training and then I've done my part for diversity and inclusion at the company. And that is really misleading and unfortunate because it's woefully insufficient. But also a lot of what the content is in these trainings is actually not super actionable. It basically will tells you about the bias that we all have. I don't know about you, but that makes me feel kind of bad because I don't like having bias, but I know I do. And then like, it's not totally clear to me what I'm supposed to do about it because you just told me it was unconscious and implicit. And that's like the part of my brain that I'm like not super good at controlling. And I know I'm not a racist, but I am biased, but we're all biased. So what do I do? So I just go back to my desk and kind of do my job. And actually there are trainings and kind of experiences that folks can have that help them understand ways in which kind of bias and blind spots are impacting their decision-making and kind of baked into their policies and procedures and operations. But it's not usually the content of these bias trainings, which are delivered in kind of often, you know, giant sort of lecture style rooms with a little bit of talking to your neighbor. And the other thing that we see is folks go through these experiences and then go back to their desk and like nothing's changed at their company, the gender makeup, the race makeup is like all still the same. And so whatever it is that they have perhaps learned, there may not be much of an opportunity to actually put it into place. So if I learn how maybe I have some implicit bias against women and then I go back and I'm still on an all-male team, then it's sort of unclear what I'm supposed to do with that information. And so one of the things that we do at Code 2040 is we actually pair up a training that we do with all of the engineering managers who are going to be managing our fellows. We also do it with HR teams, which is often a focus on kind of systems design. And when the managers go through this training, understanding things like where are my blind spots, how do I manage and supervise someone who's suffering from imposter syndrome, what is imposter syndrome, what is stereotype threat, kind of wrapping their head around all of this work. Then they go back to their desk and like four Code 2040 fellows show up and there's actually an experience for that manager where that manager learns and grows over the course of the summer alongside the students. And it's really this kind of joint evolution of what it means to be in a diverse work environment that's tangible and that comes with feedback loops. And that's really powerful as opposed to going to sit in an auditorium and listening to a lecture about unconscious bias and then, you know, going back to your desk after lunch and like moving on with your day.
So do you work mostly, I know you work with Google, do you work mostly with big companies? If like a small company is listening to this right now, can they get involved? Or is it mostly just big companies at this point?
Yeah, it totally runs the gamut, actually. So over the course of the years with the Fellows Program, I think the smallest company we worked with was two founders and then their Code 2040 fellow. Obviously, we work with giant companies. Intuit has Code 2040 fellows. We work with companies like Slack and Pandora, who are sort of in between. It definitely runs the gamut. But one of the exciting things that we're working on now is actually teasing apart kind of the various ways that companies can engage with Code 2040. It used to be that if you wanted to engage as a company partner, you had to be in the Bay Area and you had to take on interns over the summer. And we got enough demand from companies who either said, A, like we really want access to the trainings and to the talent pool, but actually an internship program is not right for us. Or companies who said, like we want access to your insights, but we're not in the Bay Area, so we can't participate in the Fellows Program. And that actually drove us to hire someone who's in the process of building out what company engagements look like beyond the fellows program. So there will be a number of different ways to engage with Code 2040 over the course of this year and beyond, kind of as a result of that demand. So if you're a company with an internship program in the Bay Area, the Fellows Program is an awesome way to engage. But if you're not that, there's still other ways that we're putting together where folks can benefit from what we're learning. Because it's part of, you know, over the last a little over five years, we've learned a huge amount. And what we've been awesome at is integrating those learnings into our own programs. So we're really good at, testing hypotheses and running evaluations and ensuring that we're iterating, in near real time as we learn things to make our programs better. One of the things that we haven't historically been as good at is sharing all of those insights out with the rest of the world. And so kind of coming back to our sort of vision for the next 3 years through 2020, it's both about growing the community to that 40,000, but it's also about kind of taking these learnings and insights and sharing them outward so that folks, wherever they are, can kind of take hold of those and use them to iterate and make change. And it's not just Code 2040 getting better, but actually the industry as a whole getting better over the course of that time.
Well, there's a lot of evidence that strongly suggests that the diversifying the tech industry will have, you know, financial benefits for companies and, you know, for everyone. But still a lot of companies are not doing anything. I want to talk about that. But first, I want to just take a break to thank one of our sponsors. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. You are geeks, engineers, or other tech geeks, you know. You want to throw technology at a problem or throw a problem at technology. And one problem you might have is the annoying process of getting a mortgage, either getting a mortgage for your new home or refinancing your home. There's a lot in the process and it's annoying and it doesn't have to be. With Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans, you can get a mortgage in just minutes using technology. You know that you can trust Quicken Loans. They've been around for a while. You're not just trusting all your financial information to some fly-by-night organization. This is Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, someone you trust. You'll get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence to make an informed decision. So you get all the information. It's right there at your fingertips, either on your phone or your laptop or your computer. It's right there and you can slide the sliders, decide how much is good for you, get the right mortgage for you, make an informed decision. Information is key when you're making decisions. And time is important too. You don't want to waste time searching through stacks of paperwork. With Rocket Mortgage, you can securely share your financial information to get a mortgage approval in minutes. You can even adjust the rate and the length of your loan in real time to make sure you get the mortgage solution that's right for you. You don't want someone else's mortgage solution. You want the solution that is right just for you. So whether you're looking to buy a home or refinance your existing mortgage, you can lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage. So skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/triangulation. That's quickenloans.com/triangulation. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. And don't forget to end that link with triangulation so they know that we sent you to them. And we thank Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans for their support of this show. I am talking to Laura Wideman Powers. Laura spent some time working in the White House, working for as a senior advisor to the CTO under the Obama administration. She also founded Code 2040. And we are talking about diversity, specifically Black and Latinx workers, engineers in the workforce. There's a lot of evidence. I mean, I'm sure you have the evidence. You've talked about a little bit about it before that this is financially beneficial to companies. But still, some companies aren't doing anything. What are some of the reasons companies aren't moving forward or going about this the wrong way?
Yeah. So I think part of what it comes down to is that it's really hard to do well, and it's hard in a specific way. companies often try to tack diversity and inclusion on to their existing operations. So let's keep going, keep everything full speed ahead as normal, and let's like glom on this diversity and inclusion function. Sometimes you see that because there's like a head of diversity and inclusion who is usually under-resourced and like in a standalone department without decision-making authority. But like it feels and looks good to have that person kind of on your team's page. It shows up in other ways as well. Sometimes there's like no leader actually takes accountability, and you see like a really junior level person who's sort of advocating and agitating, but again, doesn't have the authority to actually make change. If a company is really serious about diversity and inclusion, then it actually entails rethinking the approaches used for some of the fundamental functions. So you can't recruit in the same way and then have like a diversity recruiting function on the side. You can't hire in the same way, use the same interview strategy and process and questions and expect a different result. You can't actually manage in the same way and perhaps continue to not train or under-resource managers and let them kind of rely on their gut and figure it out as they go. You can't do that if you want to actually retain diverse talent. You have to rethink kind of what your company actually values and how that's baked into decision-making and what it looks like to run representative and inclusive decision-making processes internally and for your product. And so what a lot of companies, I think, get wrong off the bat is thinking like, okay, everything else stays the same, and then I've allocated this bit of budget off to the side and we'll add on a D&I function. And it doesn't work that way. And for some companies, like that's a deal breaker. Like they don't actually want to revisit the way that they've been doing business, which for a lot of companies kind of up to a point has gotten them to be very successful. And, you know, there's a ton of management literature about like, you know, if you continue doing the thing that got you to point A, like chances are that's not actually what's going to get your company to point B or point C. And I think the best CEOs know that. And they apply that when it comes to their core product or core business and how they think about R&D and their vision for their company. But they don't apply that to a talent philosophy or talent strategy. As much as you know, CEOs say talent is critical, talent is everything. If you think about it, like HR usually doesn't have a really vaulted place in the organization. Like usually that's kind of considered a lesser function, a support function, a background function, as opposed to a function that's really driving the ability for the company to succeed. And so it really requires like a fundamentally different mindset about what is the purpose of talent in your organization and what is the responsibility that your talent org has, and how does inclusion fit into that, and then how does that influence all of the other functions of the organization as well. And I will say the thing that, I don't know if optimistic is the right word, but that I find sort of comforting about, you know, the state of a lot of companies not being willing to change or to actually do what I'm describing, is I actually don't believe those companies will be around in 5 to 10 years. I think, you know, 2040, going back to kind of the name of the organization, it's the start of the decade when people of color will be the majority in the U.S. That's kind of an abstract demographic concept, sure, but like that's our consumer base. That's our workforce. So if companies are not able to successfully make the transition to figuring out how to attract that, retain, promote diverse candidates from all backgrounds, particularly from Black and Latinx backgrounds, I don't think they're going to survive. There just isn't going to be the talent out there And everything that is sort of a diversity and inclusion strategy or a multicultural marketing strategy or all of that that is sort of an add-on today is going to be the core of businesses in the future. Companies that make that leap will survive. Companies that don't will die off. And new companies with that type of inclusion baked into their founding will take their place.
So how can students get involved? It's engineering students. Do they have to be almost at the end of their degree program or is it the beginning? How can students get involved?
Yeah, so we have opportunities for students, post-secondary students, so after high school at all levels. So Tech Trek, the tech spring break I was describing, is mostly freshmen and sophomores. The Fellows program is mostly sophomores and juniors. All of our student-facing programs, you have to be returning to school after your participation in them. So that's sort of the big limitation. But really, for the most part, we have application processes for everything, but you have to be self-identify as Black or Latinx. You have to be currently enrolled in a U.S. college or university, and you have to be returning to school at the end of the program. We don't have a major requirement. We don't have a GPA requirement. We don't have a geography requirement. After that, it's really looking for passion and leadership and folks who are going to not just be kind of talented and successful in their own right, that we believe in them for that, but are going to be really stellar community members and ensure that they're helping bring others along with them as they succeed.
And what about companies? How can companies who are interested, how can they get involved?
So there's the Fellows program is the kind of most straightforward, but there's a number of different ways. Anyone can reach out to us. We're actually super responsive on Twitter. We have a couple different forms on our website that folks can submit. If companies are interested in hosting Fellows or gaining access to the talent pool more broadly, as I said, we have about 5,000 folks in our network, the majority of whom are Black and Latinx engineers. If companies are interested in the trainings and coaching, reach out to us via our website or via Twitter, and we're happy to have a conversation about partnering.
And what about volunteers? I see that you have a call for volunteers. Who are you looking for who want to maybe dedicate their time to this cause?
Yeah, so, always love having Black and Latinx engineers as volunteers because it is so valuable for our students to see people who look like them from similar backgrounds who are succeeding in the space. Equally important is having allies or, as we sometimes call them, accomplices in the work, folks who are not Black or Latinx, but who see the critical importance of the mission that Code 2040 is working on and want to contribute to it. And this is really important because we are not going to do this alone. And in fact, in a lot of scenarios, it is folks from other backgrounds who are in positions of power and authority, and having them walking alongside us in this work is critical to actually making it happen. So our own volunteer base is really inclusive. Again, you can reach out to us via our website. There's mentoring students. We also do things like resume reviews. So even if you're not technical, but maybe you have some experience doing hiring, that kind of coaching is really helpful. And then there's always things like, we have a lot of events, kind of staffing those events. There's always stuff for volunteers to do. So hopefully people will reach out.
Well, I want to take some time to also ask you about your 6-month stint that you had working for the Obama administration. But first, I want to take a second to thank the sponsor of this episode. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Blue Apron. I hope you're watching this while you're eating. Otherwise, I'm going to make you really hungry. So just be prepared. If you haven't heard us talk about Blue Apron, listen now, because I'm going to tell you. Blue Apron is the number one ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. They will deliver you a box that has everything you need to make a delicious, fresh meal. So make it by yourself, make it with your partner, make it with your friends, make it with your family. It's fun to make food. Blue Apron delivers in the box a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients that you can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. The pre-portioning, that is their secret. Get you out of the grocery store, get you cooking with your family, spending time with your family, and not wasting all that other stuff that you're not going to use after you make this recipe. Because that's what they get to do. They use all these interesting, creative ingredients that you don't want to buy giant bottles of. And sometimes they can be expensive, those big bottles of things, especially if you're shopping at high-end grocery stores. With Blue Apron, you can spend under $10 per person for a delicious meal. It's like restaurant quality meal. They ship the exact amount of each ingredient required for the recipe. That way, Blue Apron is reducing food waste. Their freshness guarantee promises that every ingredient delivery arrives ready to cook, or they will make it right. I've been getting boxes for a while. They haven't had to make it right because everything comes right. No bruised peaches, no cracked eggs, no leaks in the meat. We get boxes that sometimes are vegetarian. They sometimes are meat because some people in our family eat meat and some don't. And the meat never leaks all over the vegetables. So that's good. If you have a picky family who all wants a different thing, you can do this with Blue Apron. Get one meal vegetarian. Sometimes you can make the meat meals vegetarian. Just leave the meat out. That's what we do sometimes. Blue Apron delivers to 99% of the continental U.S. There's no weekly commitment. So if you like to go to the grocery store and make your own meals, or you like to go out to eat, or you don't find yourself, the whole family only eats together once or twice a week, you can do that. You can get it one week and not get it the next week. You can customize your recipes every week based on your dietary preference. If you just want to be a vegetarian this week and not next week, you can. Make sure to call yourself a vegetarian for that week when you are, even if you're going to eat meat next week. Choose from a variety of new recipes each week, or let Blue Apron's culinary team surprise you. Here's the part where you're going to get hungry. Baked spinach and egg flatbread with sautéed asparagus and lemon aioli. That's one meal you could get. Or beef teriyaki stir fry with sugar snap peas and lime rice. Or crispy salmon and roasted potato salad with pickled mustard seeds and creme fraiche sauce. None of that old-fashioned potato salad. This is roasted potato salad, which means it tastes better because it's roasted. Three cheese and baby broccoli stromboli with tomato and oregano dipping sauce. Check out this week's menu and get three meals free with your first purchase and free shipping by going to blueapron.com/triangulation. Don't forget to add the triangulation at the end so they know we sent you to them. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. Don't wait. Go to blueapron.com/triangulation. And we thank Blue Apron for their support of triangulation. Okay, so you were working for Megan Smith. She was the chief technology officer for the Obama administration. You had a 6-month stint there. How did you get there?
So Megan, actually, I joined Megan on stage at South by Southwest in 2015. It was a keynote panel conversation that was based on kind of this gender disparity and gender discrimination in Silicon Valley dialogue that was happening at the time. And actually I was a last minute addition to the panel, and I didn't realize until I walked into the room that it was like a room of 5,000 people that was being live streamed. Most of the South by Southwest panels I've done in the past were sort of 40 to 50 people. So I joined Megan on stage there, and when we got off the stage, she said, you know, I've been following the work that you have been doing with Code 2040, and I think that kind of practitioner experience is what we need to sort of pull together a lot of the thinking around diversity and inclusion that's happening at the White House right now. So Megan pitched me on it. She talked me into it. She's very persuasive, if you've met her. She's fabulous. And so I went to the White House with this sort of goal to bridge the kind of academic, bureaucratic, and industry kind of views of diversity and inclusion, because there's a lot of stuff the federal government does that's actually quite advanced compared to what the private sector is doing. And so Megan and I put together this resource, we call it Raising the Floor, kind of back to this idea that there's no silver bullets. We can't tell you from, you know, a pamphlet or a sheet of paper exactly what to do to solve diversity and inclusion challenges at your company, but we can definitely tell you if you're not doing the basics. And so the idea was to put on paper, here are the things that everyone should be doing. If you are not doing these things, then you are not doing enough. And so it was pretty simple. We divided it into leadership, retention, recruitment, and ecosystem, and pulled together the best thinking from some of the experts in the White House, from the science team, who are doing a lot of the hard science around bias and inclusion, kind of lessons learned from across federal agencies. There's a diversity and inclusion in government group that we pulled from for this. The National Security Council was actually doing a lot of really interesting work on diversity and inclusion. If you think about the what would be a business imperative in the private sector, sort of mission imperative in the security world, if you don't have undercover agents or CIA agents, FBI agents who can blend into the communities and reflect the communities that they're working in, that's a serious security challenge. So they were really motivated to think about diversity and inclusion from a security perspective. So there's so much interesting work going on that we were able to pull from to kind of put together this resource. And then the idea was to get it into the hands of folks who could adopt, iterate, and use it as a jumping off point in the private sector as well. So we published it on, you can still find it on the Obama White House website, which still exists. Don't go to whitehouse.gov. I believe it's obamawhitehouse.gov. You can search it. And it's called Raising the Floor. And it was a really fun thing to get to pull together from that vantage point, whereas I was so used to being kind of entrenched in the Valley and tech, to pull up a few levels and get to actually look around at what works across a variety of different industries was really, really interesting.
I almost hate to ask this, but do you have anyone's ear there now? Like, is there any contact? Is anyone reaching out to you for what they can do now?
Well, I think the point, and this was, true for a lot of the work happening in the last 6 months of the Obama administration, the idea was, how do we serve as catalysts? It's not for the White House or federal government to own something like diversity and inclusion in industry forever, but to actually shine a spotlight on something that that we believed was important for the country, and President Obama believed was important for the country, that we figure out how to make the economy work for everyone, and that tech and entrepreneurship were really key levers to that. So the goal was, let's take the time that we have, let's create something, and let's get it out the door so that it can be in the wild and in industry. And then every administration gets to pick their priorities and what to focus on, and hopefully get those done and out the door as well.
And so have you had any conversations, or is there any talk of this being a priority from this White House?
I have not talked to this White House.
Well, thank you for doing the work that you did do. And like you said, that report is out there. It's still out there for anyone to see. Laura, thank you so much for joining me. This was so enlightening. I love to put the numbers behind this diversity in tech problem, because so often it's just like, I'm just throwing out the words. And when people hear me, they're like, oh, she's talking about diversity in tech again. But it is a real problem. And there are real solutions that you're working on. Many silver bullets.
Thank you so much for having me.
Laura Wedman-Powers is at code2040.org. She is on Twitter also, and you can reach out. Like she said, they're very responsive on Twitter. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us, Laura.
Yeah, my pleasure.
And this is Triangulation. Thank you for joining us. We record Triangulation every Monday at 11 a.m. Pacific. If you want to reach out to me, I'm Megan at twit.tv. If you have suggestions, if you have comments on anything that we've talked about, and make sure that you subscribe to the show. That's twit.tv/try.